This year's growing season was challenged by excessive rainfall in many parts of the country, which delayed first cutting hay harvest. This harvest delay resulted in plants with advanced maturity and significantly lower quality than normal. To add insult to injury, many of these same areas of the country also had a drier than normal mid to late summer, which lowered the quantity of available hay. I'm Dr. Ron Lemonager, Beef Extension Specialist at Purdue University, West Lafayette, Indiana.
And I'm Bert Rutherford, Senior Editor of Beef Magazine, based in Wheat Ridge, Colorado.
To talk about this year's hay crop and ramifications for beef producers, we have two expert guests joining us. Our first guest is Dr. Bain Wilson, Extension Specialist from Virginia Tech. And our second guest is Dave Natsky, Editor of Progressive Publishing and contributor to Progressive Forage Magazine.
Let's begin this roundtable discussion with a question for Dave. Dave, what's the hay quality and quantity situation look like across the country?
Well, let's look at the quantity issue first, and I'd like to start with how we arrived at where we're at today. USDA provides an estimate of hay inventories stored on U.S. farms twice a year, each May 1st and December 1st, so we're due for another update in a month or so. Now, looking back a year ago, all hay stored on U.S. farms in December was the lowest since the drought of 2012, and the second lowest inventory all the way back to 1977. So, due to a smaller crop in 2018, we started last winter with lower inventories. Now, if you remember last winter, it was long, resulting in the need for increased supplemental hay feeding, which further cut into hay stocks, and we had a large beef cattle and dairy cattle herds requiring that hay. So then moving to earlier this spring, U.S. hay inventories stored on farms as of May 1st, again, were the lowest in about 6 years, and when you couple that with the cool and wet spring that hampered an early harvest, producers were scrambling to find any hay they could keep their cows fed. We did see the government step in to help address forage concerns. In June, the USDA announced provisions to hay, graze, or cut cover crops on prevented plant acres beginning September 1st instead of the normal November 1st without losing their federal crop insurance payments, and that might have provided some emergency forage supplies for producers who could access it. We don't have final 2019 production estimates yet. The latest numbers from USDA come from October 1st, and they indicated a slightly larger hay crop than 2018, but the overall impression of many is that there is, again, less dry hay made in 2019 than normal. So while forage quantity might not be the pressure point heading into winter, quality almost certainly will be based on the comments I'm hearing from around the country. With a few exceptions, that seems to be the method no matter which state you're living in. As you noted, Ron, the cool and wet spring meant a lot of first cutting hay was delayed while farmers struggled to plant corn or soybeans. With harvest delayed past maturity levels, quality suffered. When we look at moisture and drought maps in major hay and cattle growing regions, most of spring and early summer resulted in more areas having excess moisture as compared to drought, and the percentage of hay and alfalfa hay acres characterized as under drought actually shrunk to the lowest levels in 3 to 4 years. Now, while all that moisture was great and much needed, it also negatively affected harvest timing and hay quality. I checked in with some forage testing labs this summer, and early samples showed crude protein levels in hay and haylage down a couple of percentage points, and in some cases, hay was so poor that it literally wasn't much better than wheat straw. Reviewing latest weekly state and regional hay market reports, a vast majority of them indicate higher quality hay is hard to find, if available at all, and I've talked to farmers who made it through this year but have real concerns regarding nutritional quality of their forages and the impact on livestock productivity heading into winter.
Well, thanks, Dave. That's maybe not the best report that we wanted to hear, but I'm certainly hearing the same thing. Bain, what are you seeing in the eastern part of the country?
So I think Dave gave a really good answer and covered maybe a lot of things we're seeing here as well. We had a very odd weather year, as with the really the most of the country. You know, we definitely hear about what's going on in the Midwest quite a bit, but here in the Southeast, the Mid-Atlantic region, we had really constant rain throughout the spring and then really throughout the month of June. So there was a lot of sitting and waiting for a dry period to lay hay down and not get it rained on. And really, we didn't get really any measurable precipitation until really the end of September, and then we had some in the middle of October, and we got some kind of the last week and a half. Temperatures have also been higher than average, so all those things together, they make for a pretty poor haymaking year. And really our pastures have been burned up for quite some time as well, so we don't have great quantity sustaining forage either. In this kind of the western two-thirds of Virginia, specifically where I'm at, I mean, we're pretty dependent on fescue pasture systems and cool season forages. There may be some other species, but tall fescue kind of is king here. And unless hay was made very early in May, maybe that very first window, and a lot of people weren't really quite ready to get out and make hay yet, there really wasn't a chance until the first week of July. I give a lot of extension talks throughout our state, and, you know, typically we kind of probably poke fun at those that maybe don't that make their first cutting around 4th of July, but that was pretty much everybody this year. And in some cases, that first cutting was all they got. There was some second cutting hay made, but the tonnage would be pretty low because it just really wasn't worth going around and spending the time and the diesel fuel to make that second cutting. So forage quality is going to be pretty low, and then what was cut is going to be pretty limited in terms of tonnage. Anecdotally, I spent a lot of time on the highways, and I saw a bunch of hay being trucked in from out of state really early fall as people were starting to kind of think about their feed supplies for this winter.
For producers that are buying and selling hay, all right, you mentioned, you know, you're seeing semis coming in with hay kind of earlier in the fall. What are hay prices doing now, and what can we expect as we move into the winter feeding period?
That really depends on where you are and how close you are to your hay sources, I guess. Looking strictly at national averages, I'm kind of a numbers geek, and I went back through USDA records, and hay prices nationally generally peak in May, about the time old crop inventories have been used up and new crop harvests aren't yet quite getting ready to get started in parts of the country. This year, national average prices for both alfalfa and other hay both again peaked in May, at least as far as we are into this year. Of course, hay price movement is subject to local conditions, and we've seen some wide price swings. And it's always dangerous to talk averages when you can see more than $100 per ton difference between hay prices in Colorado or Arizona compared to North and South Dakota. And if you dig into the numbers over the past 12 months, given the lower inventories, many of the major hay states saw escalating prices beginning early as last November, and they continued to move higher through winter and early spring. Now, since May, most states have seen a slight softening of prices through summer as new crop forage and pasture became available. But given how everything is aligning, we could see what we saw last year, an early start to escalating prices again this winter.
So what do we do? What do we tell our producers that don't have enough hay, can't get enough hay, or the prices are too high? Any recommendations from either of you?
All right, I'll go ahead with that question. You know, something I feel like we tell our producers every year, but I think it's especially important this year, is to really assess the quality of the hay that they have and kind of determine the quality and the quantity of that hay supply, and then see whether they need to purchase outside hay, kind of see what those options are. One thing that we constantly kind of preach in our messaging is to then, once you assess that, allocate your best hay to the animals with the highest nutrient requirements. That's typically going to be your bred heifers, your lactating cows, especially the younger members there of your cow herd, maybe your mature cows that have a little bit lower nutrient requirement. Just also, a lot of the hay is sold by the bale, and we have a very vague indicator of what that quality is. And some of your bigger hay sellers or hay producers, they can go ahead and provide you with an analysis so you do know what you're getting. And I would say if you're going to compare hay across different sources, you know, probably go ahead and take the time to calculate that price per ton and look at your price per energy, per unit of energy. TDN would be our most common measure there, or crude protein. I work with a lot of our producers to kind of get them to look at pricing feeds on a per unit of nutrient basis. One tool that I often refer to is actually a lot of the different state extension services have some really good tools for doing that. And one that I kind of show to our producers is one from the University of Arkansas. I believe Shane Gadberry would have put that together. It does a really nice job, so they can put their own inputs there.
Dave, go ahead.
Something also that can be done is consider limit feeding hay to stretch those supplies. All the producers in our part of the country, they're kind of used to putting hay in a ring and having cattle on pasture, but limit time of access to that hay. I know some really good work out of the University of Illinois done 10 plus years ago that looked at limiting the time of access to round bales. Didn't see a lot of fall off in cow performance when they limited them to as short as 6 or 9 hours per day.
You know, we did some work with limit feeding hay, and basically if cows have 8 hours of access to a large round bale, they will eat virtually all they're going to eat in a 24-hour period. The difference is that we saw a lot less wastage. The cows weren't sorting as much. You know, they weren't picking through and looking for the chocolate cake in the middle of broccoli and cauliflower, right? And so I think limit feeding hay, maybe up to 8 hours a day. We actually did some work where we limited it down to an hour a day. And using neutral detergent fiber off of our nutrient analysis, we could predict how much a cow is going to eat in an hour or 2 hours or whatever the specified time we want to select. And then you can develop a supplementation strategy that would complement that in a limited hay supply scenario. So it's something that I think is sure worthwhile. Ohio State's done some work with you know, basically feeding a high concentrate limit fed amount. And that too, you know, is an alternative, I think, for some of our producers that are really short on hay. Dave, I'd like to ask you a question, and Bain as well, but how does a producer go about? I mean, normally, you know, hay is trading locally, but, you know, we may have to go out of state to get some hay in some cases. So how do you go about even contacting a seller?
Good question. I was going to mention that, like, in these parts, this time of year, we start to see quality chested hay auctions, which is primarily local hay. And also, a lot of states have now established hotlines trying to connect people with hay with people looking for it. You know, in some cases it's quality tested, in some kinds it's not, so you got to be wary of what you're getting. There are a lot of websites of hay associations, state associations, hay dealers, and those sort of things. Probably be a good start. Talk to your neighbors who are buying hay, and they might know some sources, some good sources, and have some experience with dealing with them to know if they're reputable and provide a quality product.
And in some cases, you might even be able to contact your local extension educator or the state specialist that might have some leads on some hay suppliers outside of the local region. So another idea.
Yeah. Chasing hay can be a full-time job. I have done that full-time job before, and it can be frustrating. Bain, you know, we've talked about a lot of hay being put up late, you know, very mature. Certainly a lot of hay got rained on with all the, you know, the wet spring and summer that we've had in parts of the country. What are the ramifications of that feeding that kind of hay?
So ultimately, we're setting up to have some hay that might be lower than typical levels of crude protein. That advanced maturity is going to also decrease your energy value of that hay, and digestibility is also going to suffer as well. So if we kind of translate the feeding that to our cow herd, we might be feeding the same amount of hay out there to those cows, but the plant of nutrition is going to be poorer. And I think Ron made the point about when we're talking about limit feeding hay, but really kind of match your hay supply and then do some sort of supplementation strategy to maintain kind of your cows in a moderate body condition score. That'd be a BCS range of 5 to 6. And really, if we look at a lot of research that's been done for years at many different universities, time and time again, kind of that BCS of 5 at time of calving on these spring calving cows, as we look further in the winter, is going to be pretty crucial to kind of keep them on track heading into the breeding season. I live in a part of the world that we are at least 50% fall calving cows, so those calves are already on the ground. And they probably had some pretty poor pasture or very limited pasture to graze this fall. And usually we really try to have a lot of cattle on stockpiled forages, and that just might not be there this year. So we also need to make sure we have a good supplementation strategy to keep those cows going really throughout their lactation period. And we're really headed into the breeding season here at the end of November to make sure we're keeping them on a positive plane and we don't have have some train wrecks going into 2020. We don't let a bad 2019 kind of spill over into a poor 2020.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You know, actually, I know at Purdue, they're doing a lot of fetal programming research. I did quite a bit in my graduate program, kind of the next state over there. And I think if we kind of think about the fetal programming aspect, that's a topic that gets tons of play. Really over the last 10 years, everybody's been doing fetal programming research. Kind of what I've seen is if we keep our cows in moderate BCS, they can maybe weather a short, emphasis on short period of nutrient restriction. You know, it may be 70% of what maintenance requirements are. If those cows are thinner going into the calving season or the breeding season, you know, that's when we're going to kind of push the limits of what those cows can be resilient to. And then that's when we can start to see some pretty negative production losses and negative impacts on that next calf crop.
When you're talking about supplementation, particularly on that lower quality hay, is protein your main concern, or do you need to worry about energy too?
I'd say that varies on where you're at in the country. If you're sitting here maybe in the southeast and we have a lot of full season forages, I feel like a lot of feed is marketed that protein is our limiting factor, but really and truly a lot of times it's really hard to get enough energy into those cattle. And really we're formulating a supplement strategy to meet our energy requirements, and if we're using especially a lot of corn co-products, we're able to meet or exceed that protein requirement. Now, if we go to Kansas, Nebraska, if we're more in the plains where we have a lot more kind of those summer native range type grasses, you're going to be pretty protein deficient just grazing that stuff at 4 to 6% crude protein. A lot of our forages, they can still hang in there at 11%, and that's going to be or 10 to 11%, and that's going to be enough to kind of just barely meet those cow's requirements. So I'd say that depends on where you're at and what kind of forage you're talking about.
So you really need to get a nutrient analysis of your hay as well as any stockpile pasture you might have.
Oh, yes. That's a big part of our extension messaging yet again, and we have some cost share with our extension services, at least at the county level, to kind of help producers get started on wanting to get their hay analyzed and send a sample off. And I know some of our local extension agents will have some hay probes, and they can walk people through on how to properly core those bales. And one thing that I tell producers is you do not need to pay for the most expensive test out there. A lot of times they might want to pay for the cheapest test, and I kind of tell them get that kind of mid-range test. It gives us some of our major minerals. It definitely gets us an energy value there, so we can have the tools to put together a good supplementation.
And I'd add just a couple comments to what you said, Blaine. One of them is that if we don't, you know, you mentioned fetal programming is one of the areas that, you know, that developing heifer calf in utero, we could have a negative effect on her lifetime reproductive performance, okay, by shortchanging her dramatically while she's in utero. And the same thing happens with these feedlot cattle that, you know, in terms of muscle, number of muscle fibers and those kinds of things. And then the other thing is that if we shortchange these cows, I think we run into maybe some poor quality colostrum when these calves are born. Okay, and obviously that's important from that passive immunity perspective. And, you know, there's some work that was done that said that poor colostrum quality can, you know, we always think that that's right after the calf is born and, you know, that early calf health period. But there's some work that says that calves that didn't receive enough colostrum at birth can have some negative effects on health performance in the feedlot, which is a long time away, which would suggest that maybe there's some lactational programming going on as well. And so I think it's really important that our producers get forage analysis and work with a nutritionist to develop a cost-effective supplementation strategy that will not only get us through in the short term, but also maybe have some long-term ramifications if we don't do it that way.
Yeah, you know, to kind of wrap this up, this has been a quick look at what really I think is going to be a significant issue. You know, like we said, you know, not only for 2019, but going into 2020. Not only in terms of hay supplies and availability, but in terms of impact it's going to have on your cow herd. Gentlemen, is there anything else that you think we ought to cover that we didn't discuss?
I've got a couple points I'd like to make regarding 2020. I'm up here in alfalfa country up in Wisconsin, and we've had a couple horrible winters of winter kill. And I talked to a large number of farmers already this fall who have probably sworn off the crop forever. They're going to be switching to some kind of a grass blend. So that could affect the availability of both grass hays and alfalfa hay. Second, even with all the headwinds created by trade and tariff wars, hay exports or alfalfa exports anyway, are on pace to be the second highest total ever, with potential of catching the record high of 2.6 million metric tons in 2017. In the past couple of months alone, China has become much more aggressive in the U.S. hay market, and if we do get a trade deal completed soon, their demand could grow even further. I've already heard from exporters in the West who are concerned about having adequate supplies to fill orders for foreign buyers, and that adds competition for both supply and price for our domestic beef producers. And finally, looking ahead at 2020, and this one might be out there a little bit, but I'm hearing about it in some locations that hay will be in competition with other crops for acreage next year. And we got a new kid on the block called hemp, and I'm hearing that hemp is replacing some forage production in areas as acres of that grow. So what we've seen the past couple of years might not be abnormal, but might be the new normal when it comes to both the quality and quantity of hay we're used to and we need.
Well, I'd like to thank both Dave Natsky from Progressive Forage Magazine and Dr. Bain Wilson from Virginia Tech for being our guest experts on this edition of the Beef Roundtable. Please join us again next month when our Beef Roundtable discussion will delve into the topic of how fetal programming is impacted by what we feed the beef cow.